Thank you all for staying. And this is joint work with my colleagues Benjamin Pierce and Arjun Narayan from the University of Pennsylvania. So there's a lot of data accumulating in databases every single day. And there's a lot of good uses that we could put this data to. For example, Netflix has this gigantic database of movie ratings. And every time one of us rates a movie 1 star or 5 star, you're contributing an entry to this database. Now, Netflix would like to make that database available, for example, to researchers, so that it can come up with a better way of suggesting good movies to you. But of course, you can't just make that database public, because this is not the only way in which you could make use of this information. For example, let's think of a user, let's call him Bob, who has kind of a nosy neighbor or nosy boss who's interested in whether Bob has some unusual movie preferences. For example, whether Bob watches porn. And of course, if you made the database available, that would be very easy to answer. Now, people have kind of thought about getting around this problem by anonymizing the database before they make it available. For example, we might just replace all the names of the users in the database by some random identifier. But of course, if you watched what actually happened to Netflix a few years ago, you'll know that this can go horribly wrong. For example, and the reason for this is that the adversary might have some outside information. For example, if Bob's boss actually knows that Bob has some really unusual movie preference, for example, he really hates The Godfather when everybody else loves it, then Bob's boss can just look at the anonymized database and find the record and have this very unusual movie preference, and then they can look at all the other ratings and get the information that they want. Now, there's been some recent development and new techniques to get around this, and one of them is differential privacy. And so what is done in differential privacy is that we're not publishing the database itself, rather, we're introducing a query mechanism and for allowing people to ask questions. For example, one question that you could ask is, you know, do people who like Star Wars typically also like Alien? And the other thing that's done in differential privacy is that we're not returning the exact response, rather, we're adding a little bit of random noise to it before we publish it. And this is typically okay because if we're looking for some high-level correlation in the database, then a little bit of noise is not going to make a big difference. However, if the adversary tries to zoom in on a particular individual, for example, by asking how many people in the database are called Bob and like porn, then they're going to get some response that looks like this, you know, 18 plus minus 700, which tells them hardly anything. Now, of course, I'm leaving out a lot of details, like a lot of mathematical framework and solid proofs, but the end result is a very strong provable privacy guarantee that you kind of can guarantee that the adversary can learn almost nothing from these queries. And there are systems out there now that kind of implement this primitive, for example, Pink by McSherry and Ayrawat by Roy et al. Now, if you're an adversary and you're interested in getting some private information out of these databases, then what are you going to do? Well, I would argue that you're probably not going to attack the differential privacy mechanism itself, because this has a whole mathematical framework and all these proofs to back it up. But why would you do that if you can instead just attack the implementation? So, for example, let's assume that the adversary also has a stopwatch. What the adversary can do is then send some query to the database that takes a different amount of time depending on whether or not some property is true of the database, and then they just don't care about the result. Instead, they just time how long it takes until the result arrives, and then they learn their private information with certainty. And this is devastating for the strong privacy guarantees that we're trying to provide because they just go away completely. Now, unfortunately, it gets even worse because our typical defenses against these kind of covert channel attacks aren't strong enough to prevent this. Because, and this is the reason, is that the guarantee that they're trying to provide, this differential privacy guarantee, is so strong that we can't even allow the adversary to just learn a single bit, because that would already destroy these guarantees. So the rest of this talk, I'm going to show you two things. One, I'm going to show you a series of working attacks on these published systems out there, and then I'm also going to show you an effective defense that's domain-specific but also very strong. Now, before I do that, I first have to tell you three things about differential privacy. So if you've already seen this, you know, it's just going to be three slides, so bear with me. So the first thing that I need to tell you is what these queries actually look like. And the answer is that in these systems that I've mentioned, Pink and Ayrawat, the queries are programs that the querier provides to the database that are allowed to run on the database, and then the result of the program is going to be returned to the querier. Now, in Pink, the program is written in C# or an extension of C#, and in Ayrawat is a MapReduce program. But the overall structure of the programs is the same, and this is a very specific structure. There's some overall program logic. Typically, you can think of this as a loop that just iterates over all the rows in the database and does some kind of aggregation. And then there is some computation that's performed in every single row. And this is what we're going to call the microquery. So the microquery could be, for example, like if you're counting the number of people who like The Godfather, then it could return one if the person that we're currently looking at likes The Godfather and otherwise zero, and then the rest of the query could just, you know, tally the counts. Okay, so queries are programs, and they have this kind of microquery part that looks at an individual row. Now the second thing that I want to tell you about differential privacy is how you actually figure out how much noise to add. And the answer is, it does not depend on the database, but it does depend on the query. So let's have a look at these two very similar queries that both do something depending on whether somebody likes The Godfather. Now, let's think about how much of a difference it makes to the result of the query if we add or remove a single person's data from the database. Now, in the left query's case, the kind of the difference is only about, at most one, right? Because we can only return one or zero for a single person, and that's what we're going to call the sensitivity of that query to be one. Now, in the right query, it can return 1,200 or 200. So the biggest difference you can make by adding or removing a single person's entry is 1,000. And that's why we're going to say that this right query has a sensitivity of 1,000. Now, the intuition is that the higher the sensitivity of a query is, the more noise you're going to need to add to it. So in the left case, we're going to need very little noise. In the right case, we're going to need a lot of noise. Now, the third thing that I need to tell you about differential privacy is how many queries you should answer. And the answer is that typically what people do is they assign a privacy budget to the database. And so this is initialized with some value. And then whenever somebody asks a query, then we're going to attach some kind of price to the query, depending on how private it is. We're going to deduct the price of the query from the budget, and we're going to continue answering the queries until the budget is exhausted. So we have some kind of privacy budget. I'm going to keep answering queries until that's gone. Okay, so this was kind of the introduction to differential privacy. Now let's get back to the attacks. Now in the paper, we actually have several different kinds of attacks, and I'm just going to show you one example of those. And so in this particular case, the query iterates over the database, looks at every single row, and if it finds a row that contains data by somebody called Bob and has a rating for porn, then it's going to loop for 1 second. But it's always going to return zero. Now let's think about what the differential privacy framework is going to think of this query. Now, the query always returns zero. It's always constant, independent of what's in the database. So it must be very, very private, right? The sensitivity is zero, so we don't need any noise. But of course, the query takes 1 second longer if the database contains Bob's data. And this difference is something that the adversary can observe, and they can actually use to learn whether Bob is in the database or not. So this is kind of, you know, bad for privacy. Now, in the paper, we actually show how to exploit several other channels in addition to this timing channel that I've shown you right now. For example, what you could do if you find Bob's data in the database is you could run some expensive subquery that depletes the privacy budget by a lot, and then you could just look at what happens to the privacy budget in the end. Or you could use some kind of global state to create a channel between microqueries to kind of influence the result of future microqueries. Now, you might ask, you know, so we've demonstrated that these attacks work, or some of these attacks work, in both Pink and Iribot. And you might ask, you know, what went wrong? You know, did these authors of these papers not know about this? Well, the answer is the authors were aware of this attack vector, and both papers actually have some discussion of side channel and covered channel attacks, but neither system has a fully effective defense, and this is what they're contributing here. Now, let's think about what we're going to do. You know, we want to protect these systems against these covered channel attacks. And I've already mentioned two kind of channels that could be used, one being the query completion time and the other one being the privacy budget. But of course, there's a lot of other channels that people have looked at in the literature. For example, you could do kind of a differential power analysis, or you could do electromagnetic radiation, you could do all sorts of things. And so it would seem that it's hopeless. You know, what are we going to do? But in this specific scenario of differential privacy, it actually makes sense to assume that the querier is going to be remote. So they're not going to be standing right next to the machine that has the database. And if the querier is remote, then we can focus our defense on just the channels that you can observe remotely. In this particular case, there are just three of them. So, and not the short-range channels. So first of all, you're going to see the actual numeric answer of the query. Second, you're going to see the time it takes until the answer arrives. And third, you're going to see kind of what happens to the privacy budget. And in this work, we actually were able to completely close these three channels through a combination of systems techniques and techniques from programming languages. First, we kind of use a specific language design to rule out these attacks that depend, for example, on global state. And for example, if you have an attack vector that uses global variables, we can just design the language to not have that feature, to not allow global variables. Second, we're going to use program analysis to close the budget channel. So what we do is we use a novel type system that was developed by one of the authors and that actually figures out statically, but just by looking at the query and not by looking at the database, how much the query is going to cost. And so because it doesn't depend on the database, you can't use this vector to leak information through the privacy budget. And finally, we're using a special runtime to close the timing channel. And because my time is limited, I'm not going to be able to talk about all three of them, so I'm going to focus on the runtime, and the details of the other two are in the paper. Now, how can we avoid leaking information through a timing channel? Well, one way to do that would be to just treat the execution time of the query as another output. So you could say, you know, now the query has two outputs, a numeric output and the execution time. But this is kind of really, really difficult to do. For example, it's not clear how you would define or how you would infer the sensitivity of the query in the time domain. So this is an interesting approach, but it's not the approach we decided to pursue. Instead, what we decided to do was to make the timing predictable. Because if the timing doesn't actually depend on what's in the database, then you can't use this information to infer something about the database. Specifically, what we do is we're introducing, for each microquery, remember the thing that works on a single database row, we're introducing a timeout and a default value. And whenever we kind of look at a particular row in the database, we're going to set this timeout. And if the microquery completes in less than that time, then we're just going to pad the execution time until the timeout hits. But if the query threatens to overrun that timeout, then we're going to abort it, return a default value, and just move on to the next row in the database. Now let me show you, using a very simple example, how that works. So I'm going to take this very simple database of just 5 rows, and I'm going to use a simplified version of the query I showed you earlier. This is just going to look for somebody called Bob, and if they find that, then they delay for 1 second. Okay. Now let's first see what happens when we don't have any defenses. Right? So when Bob is not in the database, we're just going to iterate through the database, right? And it's all going to be finished very quickly. So we complete the query very quickly, and the result is 0. Now let's look what happens when Bob is in the database. So again, we're going to go through, look at every single row, but when we hit the row that contains Bob, we're going to delay for 1 second. Okay. So now the query takes a lot longer, and this difference is something that the adversary can observe. Now let's see what happens when we have timeouts and default values. Now, we're going to specify this timeout, in this case 20 microseconds, and we're going to say that default value is 1. So again, let's see what happens when Bob is not in the database. So again, we're going through the database, looking at every single row, but this time, we're going to pad the execution time of every single microquery to 20 microseconds. So therefore, the overall query takes 100 microseconds, but the result is still 0. Now let's see what happens when Bob is in the database. So again, we're going to go through, but in the second row that contains Bob's data, we're actually going to notice that the query is threatening to overrun the timeout. We're going to abort it. We're going to return the default value, and we're going to move on to the remaining rows. So the result is that the overall query also takes 100 microseconds. So you couldn't tell just by looking at the time it took whether Bob was or was not in the database. But of course, you're going to say, well, didn't you replace one problem with another? Because now you actually have a different result. So the question is, doesn't this introduction of a default value change the query's answer? Doesn't that create some kind of privacy problem? And the answer to this is yes, but that's okay. And the reason is that, kind of remember from the early introduction, like all we need from the microquery to get the differential privacy guarantee is that the answer falls in a particular value range. Okay? So as long as we have the kind of default value in that range, we're safe, right? Because differential privacy already deals with these kind of dependencies of one row and the overall result. So if we kind of extend the value range of the microquery to include the default value, which in this case is 1, then it's just as if he has written, you know, if the name of the person is Bob, then return 1, which differential privacy already knows how to handle. Now, you might ask, well, if you have default values in the query result, doesn't this kind of degrade the usability of the result? And again, the answer is no, because if you are a non-adversarial query, like if you have a good query, then you can always set your timeout very conservatively so that the timeout is never going to hit. And therefore, you're never going to see the default values. The only person who's going to see the default value included is the adversary, which is what we want. Okay, so now, so we implemented these techniques in a system that we call fuzz. And so I want to quickly tell you what fuzz is. So fuzz is two things. First, it's a programming language that you can use to write these differentially private queries. And we actually designed this from scratch rather than starting with an existing language like C#, because that kind of frees us from the burden of having to find all the possible kind of channels and vulnerabilities in C#. We just started from scratch. Functionally, it's roughly comparable to Pinko Iravat, but it includes this new type system that we use to infer the sensitivity statically just by looking at the query. The second thing that fuzz is, it's a runtime that supports these timeouts and default values. And actually implementing this in a real runtime turns out to be highly non-trivial, because the problem is that we have a query that's written by an adversary, right? An adversarial query that's going to do whatever it can to overrun that timeout. And it's our job to make sure it can't. Okay. And we actually do this using a new primitive that we call predictable transactions. So let me quickly tell you what those are. So predictable transactions try to enforce three properties for every single microquery. The first property is isolation. So we want to be sure that a microquery, when it sees some kind of private information, can't interfere with the rest of the computation in some way. For example, if you see Bob's data, then the microquery could try to trigger garbage collection, or it could kind of allocate a lot of memory, or change the runtime state in some way, and we have to be able to prevent all this. Second property is preemptibility. So no matter what the microquery is currently doing, like it might be in the middle of a memory allocation, it might be grabbing some logs, it might be doing some computation, no matter what it's doing, we have to be able to abort it within a bounded amount of time and kind of get into a consistent state again. The third property that we need is bounded deallocation. So if the microquery has allocated some resources, for example, a lot of memory or logs or whatever you have here, then you have to be able to release all these resources within a bounded amount of time and get back to the same runtime state that we were in before we started the microquery. And I'm not going to be able to tell you exactly how we did this, but the details of this are in the paper. So I'm going to show you three results from our evaluation. And the question I'm going to focus on is first, is fuzz expressive enough to do kind of to formulate the queries that we want to ask? Second, is it fast enough that we can actually use it? And third, does it actually prevent all these side channel and covert channel attacks that we're worried about? Now, to kind of answer the question, is it expressive enough? What we did was we went back to existing work on differential privacy, and we took three queries from existing papers that people had motivated in those papers, and we tried to implement them in fuzz, and we succeeded in all three cases. That means that basically fuzz is expressive enough to kind of do non-trivial queries. So these queries were k-means clustering, kind of a particular way of looking at census data, and an analysis of web server logs. Now, we also implemented several adversarial queries based on these kind of good queries above, and we used kind of different variants of the attack vectors that I have described. And for our evaluation, we actually use a commodity system. So this is an everyday kind of 3 GHz Core 2 Duo running kind of a commodity Linux kernel. And the database that we use has 10,000 rows, and it contains synthetic data. And that's okay because, by definition, it shouldn't matter what's in the database. Now, first, let's look at the kind of performance, how fast it is to answer these queries. I'm going to show you the overall query completion time for the three queries that I described, like k-means, the census data, and the web log query. And first, as a baseline, I'm going to show you what happens if we kind of disable all our protections, just with a baseline runtime. And it turns out that the queries take between like a few hundred milliseconds and about 2 seconds to complete. Now I'm going to show you what happens when you enable our protections. And what you're going to see is that the query completion time goes up by a factor of between 2.5 times and about 6.8 times. Okay. Now in relative terms, that's a lot, but if you look at the absolute kind of time it took to complete those queries, the longest query took only about 12 seconds. So it's still reasonable to kind of use in practice. Now to kind of look at where does this overhead come from, we actually ran a third configuration. In this configuration, we enabled all our protections, except for this one feature where we pad the execution time of the query until the timeout hits. And as you can see, the query completion time actually increases by only a little. So it means that the overhead of our defenses is actually very small. So where the kind of increase in completion time comes from is this padding at the end. And this is because kind of the timeouts in our experiment were set very conservatively. Now, the final thing I want to show you is what happens when you have an adversarial query. And I'm going to show you results for five different queries with different kind of attack vectors. I'm going to show you four configurations. The middle ones are the ones where we disable all our protections, right? This is the unprotected system that you would have today. And the ones on the right are the protected system with all our defenses in place. And in every case, like, we use two databases, one that contained the data of the individual we're trying to kind of that the query is looking for, and one database that didn't contain the data for that individual. And this is kind of the hit case where the individual is there, and the miss case where they're not there. So let's first see what happens when the protections are disabled. And as you can see, kind of the adversarial queries are able to kind of make a huge difference in most cases in the execution time. Right, so I'm going to show you the delta between the hit and the miss case, which is in almost all cases about 1 second. Right? This is something that the adversary can easily observe. And now let's see what happens when we actually run this with our protections enabled. And as you can see, the execution times are very, very stable. And what you can't see from the table, what I'm going to show you, is that the delta is tiny. Okay, it's less than a microsecond. And this is so tiny that the adversary can't easily measure it remotely, especially over a network. Right? So the timing channel is now too narrow to be useful to the adversary. And remember, this is just one of the three channels that I mentioned, but the other two have already been closed by design, the state channel by the language design, and the budget channel by the type system. So to conclude, I've argued that these differentially private query processes have to be defended against these covered channel attacks. And that's because the demands in the differential privacy scenario are very, very strong. Right? We can't even leak a single bit to the adversary, otherwise the guarantee is already gone. I've shown you some vulnerabilities in existing systems in pink and IR red. And I've shown you the defense that we're proposing, which is called fuzz, which is using a combination between static analysis and what we call predictable transactions to defend against these covered channel attacks. So our defense it's not kind of solving the general covered channel problem. It's specific to differential privacy, but it's also very strong. And if you'd like to have more information, then there's the URL at the bottom of the page where you can get the source code and more information. Thank you very much. I'd be happy to take questions.
Hi, so that line closes all remotely measurable channels completely. Completely is a very strong word, of course. So the normal attacks on the delay defense to timing channels is to do other probes, for example, ping the computer and see if it's just doing nothing in a delay or if it's thinking. And it turns out you can tell that from the ping times. Or, for example, you could do multiple queries simultaneously and see whether on this query it's actually processing something or if it's just in its delay mode. So how do you deal with that?
Well, okay, so in response to the first one, the computer is always busy, like always fully busy, either kind of processing the query or waiting for the timeout to hit, right? So we have to actually busy wait on this to get the sufficient resolution. And if you don't want the computer to respond to pings, then I guess you have to block the pings, right?
Pings are just an example, right? It has to reply to TCP SYNs or something.
Yes, so you have to do more than what I talked about in the talk, and there's also kind of more things that we did and that I'll describe in the paper, right? For example, kill all the processes that are not absolutely necessary to kind of close down the timing variation and so on and so forth, right? So it's not as simple.
Do you do anything, do you use a real-time kernel, or is this just stock Linux kernel?
So this is a stock Linux kernel, and as a result of this, kind of we weren't able to completely control all sources of timing variation, but we've been able to control all the ones that the adversary could influence, right? But still, it means that we have to be very conservative with our timeouts, right? And if you had a real-time kernel, you could probably be faster and do better.
Right. Thank you.
Tudor Dimitris from Symantec Research. Mm-hmm. So many interesting data sets nowadays are likely to be stored in a parallel database, where the query optimizer splits a query in multiple subqueries that are executed in parallel on multiple segments of the, or multiple physical servers, right? Uh-huh. So is this parallel processing likely to help or to hurt differential privacy?
I think it's probably going to do neither. I mean, I can imagine, we haven't done this, okay? So we haven't done a parallel query setup. This is all kind of sequential. But I could imagine you could probably build this in a distributed fashion, right? So as long as you can make the query processing time predictable, it should work in the same way. But again, it'd be interesting to look at this, but we haven't done it, so I can only speculate.
Ben Fuller, MIT. You said that it's not a big deal for accuracy because you can just set the timeouts long enough, mm-hmm. but you've inherently introduced a trade-off between query accuracy and query time. If I want my answer to be accurate, I have to make it take a lot longer. Because 10,000 rows isn't a big deal, but a database with 10 million rows with a 20 microsecond timeout is a really big problem.
Yes. So the defense certainly has its price,
yeah.
right? So it's going to take longer, and with this approach, we can't do anything about it, right? I don't see the trade-off immediately because that it's not going to like the you have to increase the timeout by a little bit, right? So you measure your queries, you learn how long they take. You add a little bit of a safety margin, like 10%, 20% or something, right? And that's what we're going to set the timeout at. But you're not going to take like a vastly longer amount of time. You're basically taking as long as the query would have taken otherwise also.
Oh, so you're setting this timeout after you've measured query execution time?
No. So when you submit the query, the querier sets the timeout. The question then becomes, how does the query know what to set the timeout to? And so how we did this is basically you benchmark it locally, like on your local disk. You see how long it takes, and then you submit it.
OK, thank you.
So if you say that the courier is going to benchmark it, I mean, are you assuming that they know something about the nature of the hardware configuration and sort of are able to estimate that their local time is going to be closely representative to how much it'll take on the server? Because if they don't have the actual data, and they may not know very much about the internals of how the server is running, right?
So it doesn't depend on the data, but it does depend on what kind of machine you're running on, right? So you have to kind of know something about what kind of machine the query processing system is going to be running on, and you have to be able to estimate how long the processing takes there. So in our case, we just use the same machine, right? So we're reasonably certain that we can estimate this. If it's a wildly different machine, then you might have to be more conservative.
I mean, it seems like that's something that maybe maybe there's just some hint or something from the server of, how fast it is or how long it would take to do these queries. Also, I was curious about the early termination one.
Mm-hmm.
I was curious how that attack works and why it has such a very small delta.
That's a great question. So what this does is, what the adversary can do is they can't only make things take longer. They can also make things take a less amount of time. But this is really tricky to do because the database has 10,000 rows. In order to make some kind of appreciable difference that you can measure remotely, you have to make every micro query take a long time if it doesn't hit, right? And so that means like if you want to have a 1 second difference, the query is going to take 10,000 seconds, right? And we just couldn't wait for like a 10,000 second query, so we set it to like less than that, right? So that's why the difference is so small. But we could arbitrarily make this longer if you want.
It's essentially optimized to be sort of the shortest total execution time that gives you a measurable
right.
difference.
Right. Okay, but you can totally change it to whatever you want, like longer, shorter, whatever you want.
Okay. Cool.
Right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, speaker.